This is a concluding session of a series of five that we've done this week with hints from Phyllis Tribble's book, God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality. For those of you who weren't around for the earlier sessions, on Monday we were talking about ways of imaging God and the presence of God, various ways in the scriptures and other ways also in our own life. On Tuesday, we talked particularly about some usually forgotten or skimmed over feminine imagery used of God in our scriptural traditions, particularly the special image of God's compassion, which is closely related in Hebrew to the idea of a woman's uterus or womb. On Wednesday and Thursday and today, we've been looking at three sets of men and women who together image the presence of God. The clue that we've been taking for the whole week is from Genesis 1, verse 27, that when God created humanity, humanity was created in the divine image as male and female. So that on Wednesday we looked at Eve and that very special title that she's given, as a helper, a title that's also appropriate for God in the Old Testament. Yesterday we looked at the Song of Songs, at a picture of human love imaging the loving presence of God, and particularly the woman called a fountain of living water, another image that throughout the scriptures is used prominently for the presence of God. And today we're looking at the book of Ruth. Yesterday we were dealing with poetry, and we read a lot of it aloud for each other and sort of gifted each other with those beautiful readings. And today we have a short story, the book of Ruth. So we're back into narrative literature, a very, very easy story to read on the surface. It's a short, short story, four very brief chapters, but a story that swarms with all sorts of hidden meanings, suggested meanings, and one that really, again, taxes, I think, the religious imagination and therefore invites us to do some creating as we're going along. Phyllis Tribble entitles her study of Ruth, the Book of Ruth, A Human Comedy, because it's a story that begins with its first scene in chapter 1 with a picture of death abounding. Things are not going well at all for Naomi, and evidently not so well also for Ruth. But by the time the story comes full circle in the final scene, in scene 4, all's well that ends well, as it finally turns out. Tribble calls this book, or outlines this book, in the same four scenes that we have as chapters in our biblical division. You know, sometimes the editors of the scriptures didn't do that good of a job of dividing up the chapters. When these stories were originally written, they weren't written with chapters and verses in it. That's only something that was added much later. And they don't always divide them in the very best spots. But for felicitously here in the book of Ruth, the divisions come right at the right places, and it works out very nice. One of the things that you can see about Ruth is that the last chapter sort of picks up themes that are developed in the first chapter, because if death is abounding in the first chapter, by the time you get to the last chapter, life has overcome death. And in the middle chapters mirror each other also. So you have a sort of outside chapters mirroring each other and the two inside chapters mirroring each other. In both of those inner chapters, you have the story of Ruth and Boaz and the mother-in-law and how the Ruth and Boaz finally come together. There are three main characters in the book of Ruth. Two of them are women. Naomi, the mother-in-law, Ruth, her daughter-in-law. Naomi, of course, an Israelite. Ruth, a foreigner. a woman of Moab. The one prominent man in the story is the Israelite Boaz, who is a kinsperson of Naomi. There are a host of minor characters in the story that sort of make appearances, but either recede in the background or aren't named, so they don't appear as quite as important. At the beginning, we have Naomi's husband, Elimelech, and the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, who take as their wives the two foreign women, Ruth and her sister Orpah. But all of those characters quickly fade from the scene. Why? Because all three of those men die. And they're mentioned in one verse, and in the next verse it's mentioned that they all died. There also is an unnamed man later on who's the next of kin. In fact, he's a little closer in the kinship line, right, than Boaz, and it adds a little bit of a suspense to the story because you really wonder whether Ruth will be linked up with Boaz, because if this other man in the line decides he wants to marry her first, according to the custom, he has first choice. He obviously doesn't take the choice, and he never even gets named in the story. There is also a group of elders and people at the end of the story, and a group of women, all unnamed. So that in the just by this device of naming people or not naming people or having them fall out very quickly, you know, there are just three people that really stand out prominently: Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. Of course, there's another personality that's important in the story. And of course, that is Yahweh, who is also called Shaddai on several occasions in the story. It's rather interesting because yesterday, you know, those of you who were with us yesterday, you'll remember that the name of God is never mentioned in the Song of Songs. And we took that as an indication that at least in this particular book, the emphasis was that you don't always have to say God's name when God is actually mirrored in loving activity. Well, in this book, it's worked out in a slightly different way. The name is indeed mentioned, but it's usually mentioned when someone says, "May God bless you," or when Naomi says, "God has cursed me, his hand is heavy upon me." The writer never really says in so many words, "Now Yahweh led so-and-so," or "The Lord was doing this," or "God spoke to so." It never happens. And so the God is sort of like, you know, just a presence that sort of looms around the scene, but you never hear about direct activity going on.
What about the last chapter?
All right, that would be one exception. Does it say that he gave the conception, or that
RSV said, "And the Lord gave"? I think the Lord gave her conception.
All right. In fact, I take that back. There is one other place. Thanks for the correction. There is one other place where it's mentioned directly. You put me back on track. There are two places where God is mentioned directly. One at the beginning, one at the end. And in all the rest, it's suggested. The one place it's mentioned directly at the beginning is, it said, Naomi heard that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. That's right. And then at the end, the Lord opens, the Lord gives Ruth conception. Thank you very much. That's important. This is the two places, and so they make sort of a bracket or a parenthesis around the story so that the reader hears that, but all the rest of the story sort of develops indirectly, as it were. It's a very striking literary device. The use of this title Shaddai is rather interesting. It's a title that's used very commonly in the book of Genesis. Yes. It's usually translated into English as Almighty. So in Genesis, when you read it, it says God Almighty. It's usually El Shaddai. The other place it's used prominently in the Old Testament is in the book of Job. It's a prominent title. And this is the third place. It doesn't crop up all that often elsewhere in the Old Testament. It's there, here and there, but it would appear as though the use of Shaddai here in this story, see, is trying somehow to make a link in the reader's mind to olden times, you know, days gone past, But it's also supposed to make some sort of a link to the stories of the fathers and mothers, the ancestors in the old time. Somehow this story of Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz is supposed to put you into the mood as if you were reading an Abraham-Sarah story, or an Isaac-Rebecca story, or a Jacob-Leah-Rachel sort of a story. And the use of that title, Shaddai, gives you that flavor. It's an old-time title for God. Probably, it doesn't really mean Almighty in the first instance. In fact, it's another title that probably has feminine overtones. It appears to mean something like the Mountain One, the One of the Mountain. But that word also sounds exactly like the word in Hebrew for breast. And as you know, in most cultures, the mountains are considered the breasts of Mother Earth. In fact, Barbara, share what you told me last night about what you were just reading.
Well, I had gotten a book from the open library, and it's a story about the Pueblo Indians and how they had gotten pushed off their land by the government. And they lived in an area where there were mountains, and they regretted. The government said, well, we'll give you money, but they didn't want the money. They wanted the mountains because that was Mother Earth with the breasts. And apparently there must have been some lake or something that was even in those mountains, and they thought that was like the lake of light. So those are almost the same kind of word pictures that we were talking about the other day.
Right. So the blue lake lying between the breasts of their mother, the earth. So that may be a very interesting title. It may mean the Mountain One. It might also mean something like the Breasty One. But it comes out generally in our translation as the Almighty. At any rate, whatever the original meaning is, it's certainly using that title puts you back into the old times and makes you think in terms of those old stories of the ancestors. Well, those are the characters, and that's the surface design of the story. Now, what about the real religious themes and motifs in this story? Here we touch on precisely the same problems that we had in the Genesis story on Wednesday. On the human level, and very clearly as the story develops, the struggle is between life and death, isn't it? That same struggle that we had seen in the garden story. And something we saw yesterday also in Song of Songs, because that climactic verse at the end saying that love is stronger than death and passion is more powerful than the underworld. Life and death, it's ciphered for us at the beginning of the story. The women and, Naomi and her husband and the two sons have left Israel because it appears as though the world has gone upside down. The place that's supposed to be the place of life, their homeland, the land of promise, the land where the God of Israel is to be present with blessing, has become a place of death. There's no food, it's a famine. And so they have left their homeland and they've gone to a foreign place, Moab. That's supposed to be a place of death. That's the place where the God wouldn't have been present for them. And yet it becomes the place of life. And in some ways, that kind of reminds you of an old story about Abraham, when he and his wife had to leave Canaan because there was a famine and went into Egypt because there was food there. Or another one of those old stories in the ancient days, when the brothers, right, the sons of Jacob, left Canaan because there was no food and went down to Egypt because it was there of all places that they had to find food. And precisely there, a dead man, their brother Joseph, gives them life. See, you have the same kind of a reversal going on here, and it kind of reminds you of those ancient traditions in the ancestral stories. Life, death. How is this reflected on the divine side? It's reflected in the theme of blessing and curse that carries through the stories. Did you notice how often, on several occasions, someone will say, "May God bless you," or "May the Lord be with you," or on the opposite side, Naomi will say, "The Lord's hand is very heavy on me," that sort of a thing. Life, death are seen to be the reflection of blessing or curse on the hand, from the hand of the God. Another interesting thing that goes on, except for those two bracket statements that I was reminded of at the beginning and the end, the divine actions are fortuitous. Tribble does a wonderful job of showing this in her close study of the text. Things just seem to happen. Human actions are very deliberate, particularly the actions of the women. The major actors in the book are Naomi and Ruth, and especially Ruth. You know, they take things in their own hands, and they do things. They're very deliberate and open in their actions. The actions of the God are signaled by so-called accidents in the book, fortuitous events. Two examples come to mind. In chapter 2, Ruth makes a very deliberate choice. She says, well, remember, they're back home now, back at in the land of Israel now. Ruth is a foreigner. She says, "I'm going to go out, and I'm going to go to someone's field where I might find favor." She and Naomi have no livelihood. They're bereft of everything. And according to the custom of the land, they were to be, since they were the poor, they were to be allowed to pick up the leftovers from the reaping. And says, "I'm going to go somewhere and see if people will be decent to me and let me just pick up here and there." She deliberately chooses to go somewhere. But where does she happen to end up? Yeah, she just happens to end up in Boaz's field. And it just happens that he's a kinsperson. How about in chapter 3, when we've got another plan concocted? This time it's the two women who have concocted the plan to get Ruth and Boaz together. And Naomi says, "Now you watch the place where he sleeps, and I want you to go snuggle up to him." And when it actually comes to it, the writer says, "Now it happened that Boaz was sleeping way at the end of the grain heap, apart from everybody else." See? Gave him some extra little privacy. It just so happened. And you have a series of these just so happens in the book. Well, that obviously is the signal for divine activity. In other words, this writer doesn't choose to hit us the way some other writers do, where the God is forever giving directions. Say, "Now you do this, do that." And says, and so God led them there, and then God told him to do that. And then the God showed him this, and then he appeared in a bush, and then he came in a dream. And he, right? Direction, 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 direction. Not in this book. In this book, it's signaled in a different way. And personally, I rather like this because I usually don't get those other kinds of directions. And so I feel very much at home in a book like this, where things just sort of happen serendipitously. And then you look back over it and you say, well, maybe I was so close to the happening at the time that I wasn't aware of what was leading me. Now I have a perspective from here and can see something that was going on. At any rate, there's one other place where this is used prominently in the Old Testament, this device. That's in the story of David, after David has become king, in the family history of David, the throne succession, beginning in 2 Samuel 9. We'll be dealing with one of those episodes next week, for those of you who are still around. Very little is ever said about the God doing anything there. And yet, as the story develops, the reader is supposed to get to the point and realize, oh yes, the God has been moving this all along, so that eventually Solomon ends up on the throne. We thought it was going to be Amnon. Didn't turn out to be that way. We thought it would be Absalom. That didn't turn out. Maybe it's going to be Adonijah. Nope, it ends up being Solomon. Wouldn't you know it? See? So it's a very interesting device. Open, deliberate human activity shadowed by hidden, accidental, chancy, as it were, divine activity. One other way in which this is signaled, I think, in the story, Tribble doesn't make a great deal of this, but I think the namings in the story sort of reflect this also. Towards the beginning of the story in chapter 1, after Naomi has lost her husband and her two sons, and now all she has left are these two foreign daughter-in-laws, when she decides to pick up and go back home because she hears there's food back home again now and they're having all the leave-taking, we have this very striking statement that when they arrive back in Bethlehem, Ruth has decided to go along. The two of them went on till they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because Shaddai has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and Yahweh has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when Yahweh has afflicted me, when Shaddai has brought calamity upon me?" Now, in that play on the names, you see the power, this powerful life, death are at work here, emptiness, fullness, and the sense of divine blessing and curse. And in fact, she is saying something that she's not even aware of. Her name is Naomi. She knows what that means. It means pleasant one, happy one. Na'am in Hebrew means something pleasant or happy or delightful. She says, "Don't call me happy one, delighted one, pleasant one. I am the bitter one. I am Mara." Even the name sounds bitter. But of course, she doesn't realize that that's not the fact at all. What will develop as the story ends up is that she will receive her name back double at the end. And that when it's all finished in chapter 4, the women will reply at the end, "Blessed be Yahweh, who hasn't left you this day without next of kin." And this new child will have a name that is renowned in Israel. He'll become a restorer of life, a nourisher for your old age, because your daughter-in-law who has loved you has been more to you than seven sons, and she is now born this child. We come back to this naming motif at the end, and Naomi ends up 10 times as happy as she had been, and in fact, she had already been blessed 7 times extra. She didn't realize it yet when Ruth had decided to come home with her. And this wonderful play on the names of Naomi and Mara. Yes, please, 2 questions. First in the back.
I'm wondering if there's any place where they talk about why Ruth chose to leave the country where she was born and familiar and go away to a foreign country.
No, it's never mentioned in the story. In fact, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Please.
It's interesting that...
Pardon me for the take. The question was, does the story ever say why Ruth chose to go? We're going to touch on it later.
I think it's interesting that in using the name to die, that is a maternal name, possibly female characteristics, that then the Shaddai has brought calamity upon me is... It is, at least in this instance, having a maternal characteristic or presence bringing the calamity which, to the contrary, you have usually, at least in our discussions, have thought about the male characteristic as being the one that brings the affliction.
And of course, the calamity is only in the service of a greater good, as it turns out, because by the end, it's precisely the opening of the womb that Shaddai does, which is something we had talked about when we were talking about the womb images for God a couple of days ago. And that's exactly where you end up, finally. So that wonderful play on the name. And here's another indication of this idea of naming. When Ruth and her mother-in-law arrived back in Israelite territory, of course, people remember Naomi. She had a name. But the first person that says anything of Ruth is in scene number 2 when she goes to the field. She doesn't know it's Boaz's field. And when Boaz first hears about her, he says in verse 5 of chapter 2, he says to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "To whom does this young woman belong?" See, she's nameless in Israel. She's a young woman, and she obviously has no identity of her own. Her identity is whoever her master or her husband may be. Of course, you and I know to whom she belongs. She's already made the choice. She said, "Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people." We know to whom she belongs. But Boaz, evidently speaking for other Israelites, says of this foreigner, "To whom does she belong? Doesn't even matter that she has a name or not." We had a question here.
Wouldn't she look, even her appearance probably would be different. She came from a foreign country.
I doubt it. We're talking about foreign country between Washington and Idaho, that kind of foreign country. We're talking foreign country between northern Montana and Regina, Saskatchewan, that kind of foreign country. And they all have sub-dialects of the same major language. Moabite and Hebrew people could understand each other. It's like North and South German or something. That kind of foreigner. So I doubt that she would have looked differently in dress, or that she would have, you know, been black against white or something like that. No, I don't think that's there. What about the names of Ruth and Boaz themselves? There's some interesting naming, I think, going on there. Again, Phyllis Tribble doesn't necessarily discuss that, but it appears to me that Boaz becomes a wonderful imaging of the God of Israel. His name means something like "with strength." And when we're first introduced to him, we're told that he's a man of substance. He is a man of substance. Well, a man of substance, on the surface meaning, he's well off. He has this nice big field, he has foremen and reapers and others under him, he's respected. He's an older man too, isn't he? That's one of the reasons why he's so delighted when he wakes up and finds out that he had a better time than he thought he had. And he says, "And she's young on top of it. Blessed be you, my daughter, that you didn't choose some young buck and you came to me." So he's a man, he's well respected in the community, he's a man of substance. But as we read the story, we discover that his real substance, right, his real strength, is more than that. It's because he has this incredible generosity. And he gives this food, and he gives this respect to her when she begins to act. He does such respectful things, and he does everything to save her honor in these sort of compromising situations as well. And then he does the right thing at the end in doing everything he can to make sure she becomes his wife. Well, that overflowing generosity, of course, is the cipher for the generosity of the God who comes back to the people who are starving without food and gives them food one more time. So the name Boaz has, like, you know, it carries this double meaning. One thing on the surface, but another thing in that he himself also is a proper reflection of the image of God. And what about Ruth? That's an interesting one, because it could be taken two ways. It sounds very much like the Hebrew word for friend or companion. I put it up on the board there. Which is exactly what she is to her mother-in-law. She befriends her. And she's a foreigner, remember. In her own way, she, you know, foreshadows the Good Samaritan story. She's the foreigner befriending this Israelite mother-in-law. She's a true friend. There's another possible way that you can understand her name, however, and that's to relate it to the Hebrew verb for running water and refreshment. And so it may mean she may be one who is the refresher, which of course she does, because it appears as though the line of Elimelech is going to dry up and die out. No children. But she refreshes the line by becoming the mother, and in fact, she brings more refreshment than anyone would ever have expected, because the writer waits until the very end of the story to tell you, oh yeah, I did want to mention this to you folks. She happens to be an ancestress of David. Ruth. Because at the very end, you get this nice little genealogy that many, you know, people have said, well, this was tacked on by someone later. I very much doubt that. I think it's another one of these devices of kind of, you know, saving it and then laying it on you. Way at the end. Yes, please, a question.
No, no question.
Oh, okay, comment.
As I look at Boaz, he was well aware of the story. He was well aware of Naomi and Ruth when he was told.
When he's told, yeah.
He already knew about them. And that's interesting, though, because the society that they were in and had already passed the word around it. Naomi was there and Ruth. The other thing that I, upon reflection, was that...
Well, I think there's a problem because at the beginning, he doesn't know. He says, to whom does this young woman belong? And then it says, the foreman who was in charge of the reaper says, this is the Moabite maiden who came back with Naomi. So if he had heard that they had come back, he didn't make the connection that this was the person, whether or not he had heard of it. He didn't make the connection. He was told this. And then it goes from there. That's right.
But the other thing that I come with is that as I look at the story as a whole, as you're saying, that God does not necessarily intrude wholly as much as any other story. However, I think the intrusion is more in that the people of God acknowledge God in their midst. And they acknowledge Him in everything that they do and everything that they're doing, and see Him in life and death and in producing life and giving life in the fruits of the field and the fruits of their labor.
Yes, so that the
acknowledging at all times in their life, kind of thing.
So that the presence is coming not from above as much as from below. The presence is coming in the human acknowledgement and in the human imaging of the presence.
God is with us.
Yeah, in the human imaging.
Which we in the Christian society should look well to do that we are acknowledging everything, all parts of our life.
All right, now let's also look at the character of Ruth, since we only have about 15 minutes, and she's supposed to be the one we're lifting up today. So let's lift her up now and affirm her. One of the first things that Tribble points out about Ruth is how radical her decision was. This is on page 173, for those of you who have the book. In choosing to go home, which is away from home for her, with her mother-in-law. You'll recall the scene. Naomi has decided to go back home. Her two daughters-in-law are walking with her part of the way towards the edge of their territory. And at that point, she dismisses them. She says, they hug and they weep and all the rest. And she says, now you've got to go back home. She says, I'm not about to bear any more sons, so you're not going to be able to keep married in the family. You've got to go back home so you can, obviously the implication being, find some husbands in your own land and have children. And of course, daughter-in-law number one does what probably any one of us would do. She says, of course, that makes sense. That's the right decision. This is leave-taking time, and she takes leave. Also from the whole story, that's that. Ruth, however, makes this radical decision and decides, it doesn't say, but God came into Ruth's mind and said, but Ruth, I have a special plan for you. She simply decides to go. And Tribble says here, on page 172 and 173, Ruth stands alone by the force of her decision. Her choice makes no sense. It forsakes the security of a mother's house for insecurity abroad. It forfeits possible fullness at home in Moab for certain emptiness in Judah. It relinquishes the familiar for the strange. And at first, even Naomi rejects this radical decision, right? She says, no, no. And then Ruth says, yes, yes. Reading on page 173. From a cultural perspective, Ruth has chosen death over life. She has disavowed the solidarity of family. She has abandoned national identity. She has renounced religious affiliation. In the entire epic of Israel, only Abraham matches this radicality. But then Abraham had a call from God. Tribble is suggesting that we draw a parallel between Abraham, if you recall when he's first introduced, the call comes from the God and says, leave your homeland, leave your father's house, leave your mother's country, go to a place I'll show you, and he goes. It's a radical movement to something new. And Tribble is suggesting Ruth does something just as radical, in fact, even more radical, because the story never says that the God directly told her to go. Whatever came to her came indirectly in the force of her decision. And again, you see, that becomes mirrored at the end of the book. Because when, finally, the marriage is to take place between her and Boaz, in chapter 4, verse 11, it says, then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your house. We'll come back to that phrase too. This woman who is coming into your house. Like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you prosper in Ephrata, be renowned in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman. Some of you will read back in Genesis 38 that wonderful story of Tamar and Judah, the young woman who played a prostitute with her father-in-law to make sure that there were children in the family. Another fairly radical kind of a decision. Well, here's the direct linking again of Ruth, right, with the story of the ancestors and the ancestresses. She's linked back. And Tribble says, I guess she's implying, you know, the tradition is made so very much of Abraham. In fact, not only Jewish and Christian tradition, but some of you know Muslim tradition too. You know, Abraham was the father of all the faithful. And they make just a very big thing about the fact that Abraham left Mesopotamia, renounced the idols of his homeland, even went against his father, who told him that if he would tell anybody about this, it would bring trouble on the whole household. All the neighbors would probably smoke them out and all the rest of it, you know. And they make a big thing about that decision of Abraham to move out. And Tribble is saying, well, it was just as big a thing. If anything, it was a bigger thing for Ruth to do this. She was a woman. We're never told she had a direct word, as Abraham did. And she's going, as it were, even without a call. Of course, after it's all over, you know, the reader is to say, well, she was being called all the time. Question up front.
Well, there's a reflection. What strikes me about this, if you talk about it, and I haven't thought about it in the same way, linking her up with Abraham, is that it's as if, you know, the people look back on the event and they honor Abraham's place, position, and decision by talking about a direct call. It's the way it's honored and lifted up and made.
All right.
But in Ruth's case, for whatever reason, the way the story is written, does not receive that same honor in the sense of a direct call. And therefore, it becomes, oh, just because she loves Naomi or her, mm-hmm. is not elevated in the same way.
Yeah. Some of the people at the earlier Bible study this morning were talking about this because some of them said, well, in a way, she's being lifted up even more. And I think that's what Tribble would argue too, because it's easy for people to always say, well, God told me this and God led me there. In fact, sometimes some of us get tired when others are always telling that, because we start saying, well, when did we ever hear that? And when were we ever led that way? It would appear as though most of us are not led with direct voices and direct dreams and all the rest of it. We need to sort of, you know, go with the flow and rely upon these kinds of radical decisions too, the sort of thing Kierkegaard talked about. You take the leap of faith without seeing and without knowing everything that lies ahead. You move into the dark because you trust that there will be light there. And which is the more radical decision, I guess, Phyllis Trible is trying to put before us. And obviously she's raised a good question, because there are about 4 or 5 hands right now. People who listen to the tape can't see all this agitation, but it's here. Someone's behind me. Okay.
The thing I find is that Ruth was a Moabite. Is that what you call it?
Yes, she's from Moab.
Moab, which, as I understand, they did not know God. They worshipped idols there. And for her to make these radical decisions just shows me that she had faith to follow her mother-in-law against going back, which was the norm, but that in her pursuing of her, just her heartfelt desire, she found the nation of Israel, which was where God was. Those people were the only ones that God had made himself known to. So through that obedience and through that just heartfelt desire, God received her into his own. And for me, that's a great confirmation that not only, if you're raised in and amongst God, will you find him through revelations, but those that seek just following their heart will find him too.
Yeah, I push that even further. It seems to me that the story, you're touching on something in the story that's even more paradoxical. What's at the beginning, though? Supposedly, God is in Israel. Supposedly, that's the place of life. Supposedly, only to Israelites has he made his presence known. And yet, it's precisely in Moab, supposedly the place of death, and among this foreign woman, that he is known. And therefore, I have some trouble, you know, with your statement of that they didn't know God. I guess from my perspective, people know God at different stages in the journey. Some of us know God more fully than others. What's more important, I guess, is what Paul says, you know, that we are known fully. And all of us see only in part. And it is a very radical decision on her part to do that. One more question here, because I want to go on. We're running so out of time.
As we look at faith, and we say we have faith, but where did our faith come from? It came from God. It didn't. We just didn't manufacture it. That came from God, as the scripture says. And as we look at Ruth, and she says, I accept your God will be my God. That came from God. And we are looking at her as making the accomplishment. God is in us. Gave us that faith.
I don't believe anybody's argued that she's making an accomplishment.
Wasn't Ruth, it came in, and she said, through her acceptance of God, your God will be my God. She had accepted God, and she was no different from the Israelites or any of us.
Let's push it even further. If Boaz images God with his radical generosity, doesn't Ruth, a foreign woman, not raised in the covenant community, image God with her radical decision to go and to be with someone? Isn't that one of the most common statements made throughout all of the scriptures about the God of Israel? when the prophets get their calls, you can read most of the prophetic stories, you know, they tend to object to the call and say, we don't want to do this. They object. And the assurance always comes from the God, but I will be with you. It's already there in the call of Moses in the beginning of Exodus. It's in the call of Gideon, who wasn't a prophet, but a leader. It's there in Jeremiah's call. The God comes, the human says, no, and the God says, but I will be with you. And there's this striking passage in Exodus chapter 33. There are many in the Old Testament, but I think this is the most striking of all. It's the one where Moses has been on the mountain for a while, and we've just come through the story of the golden bull. And so Moses is slightly depressed. And he says in chapter 33, verse 12, see, he's talking to God, you say to me, bring up this people. But you haven't let me know whom you're going to send with me. In other words, he wants to know, well, what heavenly leader do I get to help me with this? And we know that you know, there are all these lesser deities and divine beings that you control, like the angel of death you sent through to destroy the Egyptians. Well, who do you send to lead us? Yet you say, I know you by name, you found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray you, if I really have found favor in your sight, show me your ways that I may know you and find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. And the God answers, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. My goodness, he's not going to send a delegate. No lesser general can be himself present. My presence will go with you. And Moses says, well, if your presence isn't going to go with me, don't bother to carry us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from all the other people on the earth? The presence and finding favor. Twice in Ruth, she says, I'm going to go to someone's field and see if I might find favor there. She finds favor in the eyes of Boaz. He mirrors Yahweh in that way. But she, in doing the going, embodies the presence of Yahweh, of Shaddai, for these people. She goes with her mother-in-law. Where you go, I will go. It mirrors Yahweh's promise here to Moses. I go with you. And she enters at the end of the book, right? Blessed is this one who has entered into your house, they say to Boaz. She has entered the house. Her entering, it appears to me, images or mirrors the entering of, you know, Israel's God into and among the people of Israel. So that if Eve is dignified by the title helper, a proper title for Yahweh in the Old Testament, and if the Shulamite, the maid of Shulam yesterday, was dignified by being called a fountain of living water, again, a proper image for God throughout the scriptures, then it appears to me that Ruth is dignified here as reflecting the image of God in her going with, her being present, just as it is said of Israel's God, he always goes ahead, he is always present. And in this story, we have the counterpart. Boaz, also the man in the story, mirrors and images the presence of the God with his wonderful generosity, kindness, and compassion. So we have played variations on the theme this week, and I would like to leave you with this thought that would be my hope, that because of what we've struggled with here and continue to struggle with, that we women and men alike will become so dignified by the Spirit to image God in ourselves, so that like these characters we've looked at, we may share the creative love and life that are God's with each other and with all creatures. These are the times.
We are the people.
These are the times.
We are the people.
These are the times.
We are the people.
By the way, I have one closing shot. I found out something yesterday I had not known. I was over in the bookstore, and I discovered that the Holden logo, the one that's got the sort of like yellow bursting thing on the top, and then these branches on the bottom, is precisely from Malachi 4:2 that we started the week with. That is the Sun of Righteousness rising with healing in its wings. And there's a lively branch coming out of a dead branch on the bottom. So you're all to make a run now and buy logos.